The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis. This is Music Weekly. This week, we herald the start of the Meltdown Festival. I'm here outside the Royal Festival Hall, the Thames flowing before me. Ray Davis is probably in that building behind me at this very moment, curating this year's lineup. We're going to be hearing from some of the people involved in Meltdown 2011. Vicky Wickham, producer of legendary 60s TV pop show Ready, Steady, Go, tells me how she's restaging a performance of the show on stage with past and present acts. Plus, Dengue Fever tell Rosie about the delights of Cambodian pop, no really, and how they came to get to know the Kinks frontman. I'll be back in the studio later on with Rosie and Pete Perfidis to listen to music by our favourites on this year's bill. That's Ron Sexsmith, The Fugs and Madness. That's all coming up in this week's Music Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome to the programme. We start slightly differently this week. I'm at the Royal Festival Hall by the South Bank of the Thames in London, where in a few days' time the Meltdown Festival will kick off. Now, for those of you that aren't aware, the Meltdown Festival is a more thoughtful, I think you'd call it, music event. Each year the lineup is handed over to a great icon of music to curate, and then they sort of cajole their friends or their inspirations or people they particularly admire into performing. Past curators have included Richard Thompson, Massive Attack, Jarvis Cocker, Patti Smith and Morrissey, to name a few. And this year, as we mentioned at the start of the programme, it's Kinks singer-songwriter Ray Davis in command. On the bill of things you might expect, there's lots of 60s acts like the Alan Price set and the Fugs, but surely the most ambitious event here will be a staging of 60s TV show Ready, Steady, Go. Yes, on a stage here at the Festival Hall. It's to include acts from the programme's past and music present. The producer of Ready, Steady, Go is Vicky Wickham, and she's here with me today to tell us how she's going to manage to do it all. Hello, Vicky.
Hello.
Tell us a little bit about how you got involved in recreating Ready, Steady, Go.
Jane Beese, who is organising the whole festival, gave me a call and said, I've just had a note from Ray Davis, who's curating this year, and your name's on it. Okay, why? He'd like you to recreate Ready, Steady, Go. He knows Ready, Steady, Go broke the Kinks. Can you do it? And I said, oh, absolutely, that'd be fun. Why not? Little did I know what it involved.
So what sort of people have you got lined up? What people are performing?
The concept for this show was trying to be the concept of what Ready, Steady, Go was, meaning we would have the current acts, we would have acts from America, particularly the Motown Stax R&B acts, we would have slightly odd acts. We'd mix them up. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't chart toppers or anything, it was that. So I quickly sort of did a list in my head of the older artists who had been on Ready, Steady, Go, who were still relevant. I didn't want it to be an oldie show where you went to see the Stylistics, the Temptations. So I went through, and Ronnie Spector of the Ronettes, Sandy Shaw, absolutely perfect, Manfreds. Then we started to add other names and other people. Paloma Faith, I'm a sucker for presentation, and I think, you know, she's just one of the best. A really great young guy who's, I think, 20 years old, but he'll grow up soon. Loic Essien, great new record, really, really good, and, you know, we'll add some flavour to it. Carl Barat, who was, of course, Libertines, and Nona Hendrix, who appeared with the Bluebells, and then, of course, went on to Lady Marmalade and LaBelle fame. So we've got a nice mixture.
And how's the sort of presentation of it going to work? Because one of the famous things, I suppose, about Ready, Steady, Go's presentation was that the cameras were visible by default because of the size of the studio that you were working in. And you used to use the cameras often as sort of part of the actual setup. How are you translating that sort of slightly odd, claustrophobic feel that Ready, Steady, Go had to the sort of quite grandiose setting of the Royal Festival Hall?
We're not trying to pretend in a million years this is a television show. This is a stage show with a lot of different artists that's going to run very fast, back to back, no pissing around, no changing amps and drum kits and all that stuff. We've got a great band. We'll be set just behind the artist. And the artist will come on, sing. Anybody who's got songs that we know will sing them. I think there's two covers in the whole show, because I hate covers. It begins to sound like, you know, Friday Night Holiday Inn.
Well, hi there. This is Keith Fordyce welcoming you to a very special edition of Ready, Steady, Go. For those of you who don't know this show, I might say that each week we invite all sorts of pop singers along here to Studio 9 in Kingsway, London, and the crowd who come in.
Sort of talk about recreating the spirit of the programme. How would you define the spirit of Ready, Steady, Go, do you think?
total chaos. But that was in a way the secret of Ready Steady Go. We never got it right. Each week we would try harder, but you know, something would always happen. Somebody'd fall off a rostrum, you know, camera would nearly mow down a very pretty girl dancing, you know. And that was the fun of watching. It was a live show and you watched to see what would happen.
I mean, to what extent was that sort of chaos, do you think, a result of, I don't mean this in an insulting way at all, but your own inexperience as a producer, because you hadn't been that long out of university, really, and you would appear to me to have been thrown into producing Ready, Steady, Go, you know, an untested format, nothing really like it on television at the time, pretty quickly.
Okay, first I didn't go to university.
Oh, I do apologise.
Okay, no, it's fine. I wish I had, but I didn't. I came out of school and went to what was called in those days Secretarial College, and then went to work actually at BBC Radio Light Entertainment. I got the job at Rediffusion because a girlfriend of mine was going out with the producer, Elkin Allen. And Elkin put together Ready, Steady, Go from a radio show. It was his concept. And no, none of us knew anything about... I hardly knew who the Beatles were. I had to look up Brian Epstein. But Elkin Allen was brilliant in terms of... We were all young. And when Kathy McGowan came in, she was like 18 years old. Michael was, I think, 17. Michael Lindsay Hogg, who directed, was 23. I mean, we were a young team. And Elkin let us do what we want. We could book who we want. We could go and see acts. And I don't think anybody these days would let, you know, three or four crazy people who really, you know, were just going by gut instinct, no knowledge really. And, you know, as you know, the show kind of reflected. It was like a mirror of London at the time. It wasn't just the music. It was what was going on in the art world. George Best was one of the best people we ever had on because, of course, he was, you know, the footballer, and Pete and Dud. We were a very fashionable show, you know, with Barbara Halaniki and Bieber. It was a wonderful time.
One of the things that's striking, looking back about on Ready, Steady, Go, is your ability to break acts and your ability to break artists, and not just because you had them on, but because if you sort of believed in an act, you'd have them on time and time and time again. The powers that be were perfectly happy to let you just keep kind of plugging your favourites.
Unbelievably, yes, they absolutely didn't stop us. The only time that they intruded or got involved at all was they had booked Paul Simon for a folk show which went off the air before he'd taped it, and he'd come over, and Elkin said to me, you're going to have Paul Simon. And the song was I'm a Rock, which was a little down and a little long. So Michael, of course, says to me, could you go tell Paul that he's going to have to cut it? So, yep, hello, Paul, I'm Vicky. You won't want to hear this, but unfortunately, you're going to have to cut out a verse. Still too long. Paul, I'm really sorry. Vicky, it tells a story. I can't keep cutting out verses.
There is a kind of myth around Ready, Steady, Go. It's a mythic television programme. And to one of the reasons I think that's arisen is because it's not seen very often. You see bits of it. You know, it's never been repeated in its entirety. I know Dave Clark owns it, owns the rights to it. I can't ever remember seeing an episode of Ready, Steady, Go repeated, you know, in my lifetime. Is that something that you'd like to see, or do you think that if it was repeated, it would sort of dispel the myth a little bit?
I think it's such a shame, because what is in existence stands up so well, and it most of it's black and white, which is, you know, extraordinary. The way it was lit was extraordinary. The way it was shot, the artists, yes, the fact that we would have on a lot of people that, you know, you didn't know, the Mark Bolans, the David Jones before he was Bowie, a lot of the American artists. And no, I would love to see it on. And it drives me mad when there are documentaries which should include some of the footage and never do. I think it's a crime.
I think one of the few ones that I may have seen, I don't even know if I've seen its entirety, I've just seen clips on documentaries about Motown or about Dusty Springfield, is the Motown special that you did, which just seems, in retrospect, a genuinely remarkable and impossibly exciting bit of television. What are your memories of putting that show together?
The Motown Review had come over and were playing gigs, and of course nobody knew them. So we went to the first gig, which was somewhere like Croydon, and there honestly were 50 people. And, you know, we all went, oh my God. We hope that the powers that be at Rediffusion don't find out this, because they're going to cancel our show. So we had The Supremes, The Temptations, Smokey Robinson, The Miracles, Martha and the Vandellas, Little Stevie Wonder, Earl Van Dyke, and of course hosted by Dusty. And it was a magical event. And to have everybody in the studio at one time doing their songs, it was like you died and gone to heaven.
Dancing in the street, and here with their very newest success, Nowhere to Run, it has to be Martha and the Vandellas!
The loveliest things about it, I think, is that you can see the absolute excitement on the part of Dusty Springfield that she's been, you know, who'd been marketed as a pop singer, but her heart was clearly in soul music. Finally getting the opportunity to go, this is what I want to do, this is the music I love.
Yeah, no, and it is, and it also, particularly with Dusty, who was so nervous and so, you know, didn't enjoy a lot of performing, etc., later on because it got to be a chore, but absolutely had the time of her life at that show.
That's Vicky Wickham talking to me earlier at the South Bank Centre. You can see Ready, Steady, Go at the Royal Festival Hall on the 11th of June. There's more at southbankcentre, all one word, .co.uk. I'm back in the studio now with Pete Perfidis. Hello, Pete.
Hello.
And Rosie Swash, as ever. Hello, Rosie.
Hello.
You're right. We're going to go straight into a kind of a version of Singles Club, where we're picking three tracks from artists who are performing at Meltdown, as opposed to new tracks. We'll start off with Rosie's choice.
In my face, there was no way to tell. It seemed like all was well in the world. But the neighbors said her mother had lost her will.
Ron Sexsmith, Strawberry Blonde, Rosie's choice. Are you a Ron Sexsmith fan? Well, fairly obviously you are.
Well, no, I mean, you know,
I
mean,
hate him.
Absolutely. Well, did have to pick from the list. I don't hate him, but I am quite intrigued by him as an artist because he's managed to become, I think, sort of musician's musician.
Very much so, yeah.
And in his, so I've tried a couple of albums in a row, I've tried to get into him and never quite seen, because when he does get praise, he gets this incredible amount of praise. Mm. And I've tried to see it, and at his best, I can see he's a little Jackson Brown, which is what I like, and I think this song falls more into that camp. And at his worst, I can compare it to sort of John Mayer territory.
Did you watch that documentary that was on BBC Four about
Love Shines?
The one that went on for about 5 hours.
Well, this is it. I mean, you know, that's what I don't understand. I didn't actually watch it.
It was a difficult thing to sort of for me to get my head around because it was, as you say, packed with big names talking about Ron Sexsmith and these, you know, like Elvis Costello or whoever, in these incredibly hallowed terms. This guy is one of the greatest songwriters of all time, and yet it's incredible he's not had this recognition. And tum. And he was making a record with, oh, I can't remember who it was, somebody like Mutt Lange, but it wasn't Mutt Lange. Anyway,
oh, really?
Yeah, like a big, he'd sort of basically cashed all his chips on making a record with this big producer. And it was just, you know, the music seemed really kind of good, but just I couldn't quite get what the thing was.
It's kind of when you're a musician's musician, it's commercial death, isn't it? It's,
you know, yeah.
You just either because of that, you end up having no hits, or maybe you're called a musician's musician because you hadn't, you know, because there aren't any kind of hits to kind of define you. But he's kind of a peculiarly easy person to feel sorry for in a way. And I was sort of thinking about this on the way here. And I was thinking, are the reasons musical, or could it possibly be because, and you know, maybe I had a bit too much time to think about this, because he's got the sort of he has the head of a fat man superimposed onto the body of a thin man, which is fine. I don't mean that, you know, judgmental, because I'm quite a fat man myself. But I would just think, if I had the head of a fat man then I would just go ahead and you know, eat more. Just
enjoy, yeah,
you
yeah.
Know, and just no, be just give myself the body of a fat
I did
man
think,
well.
Because there's, I watched this interview with a very, you know, effusive American interviewer just saying, this guy is a genius. And Ron is monosyllabic, just sitting there looking so uncomfortable. And he's like, and his first question to Ron Sexsmith was like, why aren't you a big pop star? Which and Ron Sexsmith said, good question. Which I thought, I don't think that is a good question to open an interview with.
I've been asked it a million times as
and
well.
It did cross my mind that he'd, you know, I mean, he doesn't have the charm that I think he would need to be a big pop star.
He's not the charisma I think he would need to be a big
pop
star.
Well, you hear, you know, other people, he's one of those people who I tend to prefer when other people do his song, apart from Rod Stewart, which
I didn't know.
He did one song,
Secret Heart.
Yeah. Which Feist also did, rather better. Rod Stewart is one of those odd people who, when he was very rude about he covered Downtown Train by Tom Waits And he basically said that Tom Waits should think himself lucky that, quote unquote, a proper singer had come along to do it justice.
Is that a gravelly voiced singer versus gravelly voiced singer thing?
Yeah, it's like a much less interesting gravelly voiced singer than the one who did it and wrote it in the first place. But yes, sorry, I digress.
No. It's interesting. I think, going back to his appearance, which is obviously not what we're here to discuss, has a little look of Rodney Bewes from whatever happened to the Lightly Lads about him. There's just some, that was what struck me while I was watching that documentary. And you know, when something like that happens and someone tells you something, like when someone says, have you noticed that Gerard Depardieu's nose looks like a penis? Which it does. It looks like the end of it. And you basically can't watch any films
like,
with Gerard Depardieu afterwards.
Cop-mates.
Yeah, and you see, all you see is basically this kind of acting penis. It was like that. Once I'd thought of Rodney Bewes, then the rest of the documentary was like
razor light. I just see this singing penis, but I think it's a slightly different reason.
But again, I digress. You could tell his work is all of a quality, and that song that you brought in, Strawberry Blonde, is lovely.
Yeah, it's very
nice. Beautiful song.
Mm. He's a huge Ray Davies fan. He always has been for ages, and right. I searched very hard, and all I could find, except for the Meltdown material, was Ray Davies going, he has a nice voice.
But I imagine Ray Davies isn't the man who gives his compliments that easily.
No.
Let's move on. This is Pete's Choice. That's Madness from their last album. The title track from the last album, The Liberty of Norton Folgate. Pete, you brought that in.
Local band. I think that might do quite well.
You're clearly... I mean, who isn't a Madness? I'm wary of saying this because previously on the show I said what I thought was a fairly inarguable statement, that if you didn't like kind of mid-60s Motown, you probably didn't like music. And this guy wrote in, he was, how dare you such... I don't like... you know, and it's...
Who wouldn't be a Madness fan? It's like Gavin Bryars or someone very like
you don't like, wow. Probably don't like music, Rosie. First of all, Pete, explain to us why you chose this.
How surprising it is for a group like Madness to turn in what might actually be the best album of their sort of collective life. And not an unambitious album. That song there is around 10 minutes long, I think, maybe even more.
Really?
Yeah, it's this kind of sort of phantasmagorical sort of love letter to London, past and present, and what London, and the idea of London as well, which they really do it just such great justice over, this place where sort of dropouts and people who can't fit in anywhere around the world can sort of go in, go to, and just feel at home in. And I thought sort of, you know, now more than ever, that's a great thing to be reminded of. And the music is just fantastic. So that's an album that's, you know, for anyone who's ever liked Madness, that's an album I think that's well worth having. And, you know, in terms of the kind of lineup of artists who are on Meltdown, I think they're probably the show I probably most felt like going to see.
Mm. It's still good live.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw him at Glastonbury. Terrific.
That was a real sort of... I don't think anyone expected to sort of be so moved in a way.
No, no, no. It was a big kind of emotional...
Was it them and the Specials played one after the other?
They've played on the same evening that Blur played. So there was definitely a sense. So it's very easy to forget the in-between was Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, which might not have been the best bit of programming.
good old Glastonbury.
But you could have a little sleep then, and be refreshed for Blur. But no, there was just watching everyone sort of bobbing up and down to It Must Be Love. And they do this thing which, listening to Madness, I'm slightly reminded of how the way, especially critically, the way we respond to sort of levity in pop music has changed. And I think that really brought it home to me when Blur released Country House, which, you know, to many people seemed like this kind of unforgivable kind of lapse into sort of wackiness. And it seemed like a line of cool had been transgressed. And I just thought, like, 10 years previously, you know, Madness were... It was okay for Madness to do both, to be both moving and to kind of be a bit silly and to sort of, you know, do have songs that really moved you, like sort of Our House and One Better Day, but also have the sort of, you know, like throw out Driving in My Car or something like that. And, you know, they're a good reminder that you can be both.
And the impact of the... It's kind of weird, isn't it? Because I remember when I was a kid, Madness were kind of like the band everybody liked at school, particularly when I moved to the South, when I moved from Yorkshire to the South, they were like the big band among 12-year-olds. And you look back on the records that people liked, and particularly, I remember in Grey Day.
Yeah.
I just think this is like my Joy Division. This is like the most miserable record, you know.
Yeah.
And yet, somehow got away with getting it into the, you know what I mean, top 10... under the guise of it being that nutty sound, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Tim and I doing a couple of radio shows this week for Domino Radio, and the theme that we are doing was the first one was our childhood records, and the second one was readers' childhood records, and it's really interesting to see what comes through. Madness came through quite a few times. There are, you know, like bands like Madness, a Kate Bush type figure, where kids will just completely fall in love with it on a level that you maybe lose the ability to appreciate when you get older, I think.
I think that's probably a fair point.
Kate Bush sort of certainly, maybe to girls, you know, I remember my other half sort of saying that her and her sisters would sort of turn out the lights and kind of sort of dance around dementedly to Kate Bush,
and Babushka and stuff like that, just, you know, considering what it's actually about, kids just going...
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, yes, no, I think that's very true. I was going to say something brilliant about Madness, and I've totally forgotten what it was. But you're not a fan, nonetheless, Rosie.
No, I think I didn't. You know, it could just be an age thing, but they've always just represented something a bit. You know, that it seemed like everyone was having tremendous fun, and I just couldn't. It just didn't quite connect with me.
Mm-hmm. That's fair enough. You don't like people having fun.
So I hate fun.
Just play. Get the 45s and just play them at the wrong speed. And then you might
really slow or really
slower. You might find that you prefer them.
Sound a bit more.
Just imagine it's Nick Cave in the bed.
Sound like Salem if you do that. Sound like what's it? What's that kind of music called? Rape wave or something?
Rape gaze.
Who came up with that? Salem. You know you were Salem. Where did the workers say that? We're showing our age here, Pete.
Some kind of reflection of the term witch house and statement.
Witch house is a feminist statement?
Well, no, it was a sort of feminist statement about witch house. I think we probably got it wrong, and no doubt someone on the internet is going to correct us, but it was some sort of statement.
I think we're going to cut this bit out of the programme entirely.
I told you I didn't like fun.
Okay, well, that's Madness with the Liberty of Norton Folgate. They obviously are appearing at Meltdown, as everybody is appearing at Meltdown that we're talking about. Finally, the last track from me. This is my choice.
Thank you.
That's the Fugs from their 1965 debut album, the Fugs' first album. That's Slum Goddess. The reason I sort of brought this in, it's similar to what Pete said. Of all the artists that are lined up at Meltdown, I'm probably most intrigued to see the Fugs, just because I don't really know what they're going to do, because their ranks are diminished. The sort of two key figures in the Fugs are Ed Saunders and Tuli Kupferberg, and Tuli Kupferberg died a few years ago, so I don't quite know what they're going to do or how it's going to work out without him. I first heard them actually quite recently, about 3-4 years ago, and I think they're a really intriguing band, the Fugs, because they seem to sit in the middle of lots of different kind of genres and lots of different almost artistic arenas, in that they predate rock and roll in some ways, because they were beatniks before. I mean, Ed Saunders were writers, Tuli Kupferberg is mentioned in Howl by Allen Ginsberg. So they were around on that scene. They're also sort of part of that New York folk scene, which from whence Bob Dylan, etc., sprung, but were clearly very irreverent and scabrous and confrontational compared to everybody else in that scene. And they also seem to me to be part of something that was very rarely discussed, weirdly, given that we do rake over the history of rock music so much, which is this kind of tradition of almost like New York street rock, 60s New York street rock, which people like the Fugs, the Holy Modal Rounders, David Peel and the... David Peel and Lower East Side. And actually, the band that key into that, if you hear the original first set of demos, the Velvet Underground, who sound kind of folky and not at all how they ended up sounding like. And I just think it's an intriguing thing, an intriguing area of music that I don't know that much about. The Fugs, it's obviously 1965, it's running in parallel to garage rock, but it's clearly coming from a completely different place. They seem to be totally musically incompetent in a way that... sort of defies belief.
That was good. That had a nice sort of distressed sort of surf rock quality.
Yeah.
That was quite appealing.
There's other stuff by them that's kind of acoustic or just sort of droney and has no tune at all. The lyrics are pretty kind of incredible for their time. I mean, not that this is anything to be proud of, young people, but I think the Fugs' first album is the first rock record anyway to use the word fucking. I think that's the first time it's heard. It's on a track called Nothing, the last track on that.
Yeah, but their name is a sort of slang, isn't it?
It's Norman Mailer. It's from the Naked and the Dead, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, so meaning the same thing.
Same thing, yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of a weird thing, because it's obviously heavily politicised music. There's a song, the most famous Fugs song is probably a track called Kill for Peace off their second album, which is obviously a satire about Vietnam. Mm. It's
is also that the one where they say, I don't want to go to Vietnam, I'm just going to stay here and screw your mum? This is one of my preferred.
Which brings me to the other aspect of the Fugs' oeuvre, which is that it's very kind of its time. It's a terrible phrase to use. It's not politically correct at all, and not in a good way. It's incredibly sexist, a lot of it. It's really kind of it gives the lie to that adolescent kind of like locker room, humour thing going on. It's a complicated and interesting thing in a world where we like music to be quite streamlined and to fit in one category. I think they don't.
Are you going
to
go?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, sure. Yeah. It's tomorrow, I believe. It's Saturday.
Yikes.
So, I mean, I don't know what they could be absolutely dreadful.
Well,
for all
yeah,
right.
They're, as you say, somewhat diminished in number.
Mm.
But that's so that's what 2 days before the Ready Steady Go thing is.
Same day. Yeah.
Oh well, so there you go. You can pitch up for the day.
Do both.
You're just planning Alexis's sort of schedule. Well,
that's
now.
That's very nice of you.
Yeah.
Take the kids.
Get a travel car. You know, it'd be all right. A little packed lunch.
I think there's a gourmet food fair at the back. You can take your Arantini to into the back, and you know.
My Arantini?
Is that Arancini? The sort of mozzarella rice ball. That was the first exotic food that came into my head.
Are either of you fans of the Fugs?
I've only heard 2 or 3 songs really, and that was probably my favourite. But I only heard that and sort of this morning when I knew we were sort of coming on here. But that was I'm always up for a catchy song played by people who sound like they can barely play it. So that's a good that's a good sort of tension.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Rosie?
No, so same as Pete, I wasn't really aware of them and gave them a good listen today and was very intrigued by them in the same way that you were. And I read a sort of biog that someone had put together online where the opening sentence was, you know, they were possibly the first underground rock band in America.
You could make an argument for that.
Yeah.
I think if you define underground as in being part of the artistic underground, you know, Demi Moore, yeah, probably, because they were, I mean, if that album comes out in 65, they were probably playing in 64. The Velvet Underground's first demos are recorded in late 65. But kind of slightly oppositional, I think, parts of that New York scene, I think they come from. But the folks seem to have a minor sideline in songs really taking the piss out of Andy Warhol. So
I bet they were laughing on the other side of their face when Andy Warhol said, "Fine, I'll work with the Velvet Underground. I'll design their sleeve."
I find them an intriguing and interesting listen. The Fugs are playing at Meltdown on the 11th of June at the, what's the one, the little one next door?
Purcell Room.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Smashing.
Be in now, there with your mozzarella balls.
I will, I'll be sat there. It's just the way I walk. It's a medical condition, and I thank you not to joke. Now, we'd like you to leave your picks from the Meltdown Festival lineup too. Your thoughts on our choices, we'll be interested to hear those. Do it at the Music Weekly blog, that's guardian.co.uk/musicweekly, or tweet us at Music Weekly Pod, all one word. Thanks for the retweets, as usual. Some comments from last week's show that have been left on the website. iSmurf, not to want to be argumentative. You know where this is leading. But having listened to Gloss Drop for the past month, I feel like it's a fairly easy listen as opposed to a slog. We're talking about Battles here, who we had on the show last week. Much like last year's Inner Speaker by Tame Impala, great album, I really feel like this album is most in its element when listened to in the elements. To be more specific, in great summery weather.
That's an interesting thing to say.
Because you would normally think Battles, you know.
Sort of indoorsy.
Yeah. Not summary.
No,
I'm going to go to the beach
and
listen
to Battles.
It
makes me think of being in a windowless room. Maybe that's because that's what their first music video like.
I think if the weather holds up, as it has in the past month, tunes like Ice Cream, Sweetie and Shag, Dominican Fade and Sundome will really come to the fore. Interesting point. We watch and wait. P.S. Did De Brat actually say that?
I don't know. I'd have to take it out with BBT. But
do you think he made it up?
I don't think
he will say almost anything to try and impress us, won't
he? And he's desperate to get a rap career going, so, you know, could have
been. He would be like the most amazing rapper. just the most amazing looking guy.
Yeah.
He should join, like.
Young Money.
Young Money.
Him and Lil Wayne.
Whilst aware of the Pied Piper's lines, that De Brat line left me a little agog, says I Smurf. Left me quite agog, too.
Especially because she's been around for us, probably like 45 or something now. It's quite weird for her to come back into the rap scene with a really explicit verse and no one knows what she's been. I mean, I'm sure some people do know what she's been up for the last few years. But.
Well, you know, she's certainly got noticed.
She's that old trick.
Tiresias 42. Best porncast. That's what we should do instead. Best podcast in a while. Not meant to be negative about previous ones. Hehe. As per Bronze, I do like the idea, and it seems to me an excellent way to bring together obsessing over a piece of music and the internet's lack of attention span. This is the self-generating piece of music that we had on last week. That said, you can see it being very, very niche, and also suspect you will need to make music for it. That's a very good point, actually, yes, which is what Ben, I think, was saying, isn't it? It brings up questions of if a song is the sum of all its parts or just the bare minimal core of it. Interesting. It'd also be heaven for totally indecisive artists to stick stuff out without spending a year trying to perfect it. The Lars. The Lars album will finally come out as a piece of self-generating.
Ever-changing.
Not that it hasn't already, with the 37,000 different versions of There She Goes you can currently listen to if you're a very boring person. On the other hand, it could be slightly like masturbation. Marshall Stack says... Marshall Stack coming at us with, I have to, a tangential point, but an intriguing point nonetheless.
That's because we were talking about tangential points on the pod last week, wasn't it?
The whole, let's be honest, Rosie, every pod is one long tangential point, isn't it?
Sure.
Marshall Stack says, when are we going to get a review of Status Quo's new album? Quid pro quo.
Brilliant. He's been leaving that on all sorts of blogs.
Do you think he might be working for the Quo?
I don't know.
What I really mean is I want you to review Status Quo's new album, Quid Pro Quo, okay? Lots of blogs. I don't know.
That's not the one. Didn't they do one for the soldiers? They did a sort of army album.
It was In the Army Now. They did a cover of In the Army Now. That was on Saturday night. They showed it at prime time, the video for that, on ITV on a Saturday night, immediately after a documentary about Simply Red. And it was like my father-in-law had suddenly taken control of ITV. God, any minute now, it'd be Tina Turner live.
Yeah, let's get some of that Eva Cassidy.
One of the most literal songs ever written.
It is just about, because I thought maybe there's some sort of point. And then I realised, as they were standing, singing it to start, it's just about being in the army.
They're just putting it out there. It's like a careers officer. You could almost do a careers officer kind of album compilation where they just went through all the professions.
Are there any other songs we can think of that are that?
Just literally describe
a job.
Yeah, probably on children's albums.
There's that one by the Stereophonics. About the guy driving the Securicor van. It's called Every Day I Think of Money. And the opening line is, I drive a van, it's full of money.
Fair enough. Money for Nothing is a little bit,
removal.
Yeah, if you were trying to explain to an alien what, the kind of, both the practicalities and the kind of microculture of removal, delivery, removal firm life was, then why not play them Money for Nothing?
But that's already got too many levels compared to In the Army. Already says way more than In the Army.
I'm groping in the dark, I'm sorry.
If you want to get a job at the post office, fill in this form and we'll do some checks. I mean, that would be a long...
You're a postman now.
If you are listening to this, if anybody's listening to this, write in with descriptions.
Hey, you could use the generating software.
That would be amazing.
To write your own, this is the job
boring
I do song.
Boring,
really
song.
Boring, really boring song. That change in slightly boring ways every time you listen to it.
I can imagine, if on the mathematically almost non-existent off chance that Bill Callahan might be listening to this podcast, I can imagine him doing a very good album of descriptive albums that merely describe what different professions get up to.
Workaday jobs.
Yeah, in his customary droll.
Well, that actually... Which brings us back to Meltdown, Ray Davis.
Yeah.
Autumn Almanac, very kind of like prosaic song about being a gardener.
But that's a lot of his songs, isn't it? It's characterful.
Nishville, talking about battles again, said, if these bits I've heard here are representing the new album faithfully, which they certainly were, we weren't making them up, all I can say is that Ty and I should have left much earlier. This is great. Well, a vote in favour of the new battles, the new vocalist version of battles. Excellent. Keep all your comments coming in. Love to read them. Okay, Rosie, Dengue Fever are on the Meltdown lineup on Sunday night, and you have been speaking to them.
Yes, LA-based band who have a Cambodian singer in the band. They've been around for about 10 years, and they formed after a couple of the founding members were on holiday in Cambodia and discovered Cambodian pop music. They're going to be playing... Meltdown, so we tracked them down. They were driving down the Pacific Highway, and here they are.
I hope they pulled over before
the
call.
The guy that took the call handed it over to Ethan, the bassist, who wasn't driving.
Wow. I would hate to think there was some sort of Music Weekly based fatality.
Me too.
Dengue Fever formed about 10 years ago, and it all started when I traveled in Southeast Asia for about 6 months. And when I went to Cambodia, I came across some music that was really inspiring that was recorded in the late 60s, early 70s, before the Khmer Rouge came in and did their awful, genocide. So there was some really good music there, and I collected some of it. And then a few years later, my brother and I formed Dengue Fever, and we started our band based around this style of music, which is Cambodian psych. We've had four albums out. We went to Cambodia and toured, played music there for a bunch of villagers. It's pretty incredible.
10 years and four albums. You must have really fallen in love with Cambodian pop music, or psych music, as you were calling it before. What is it about that music that grabbed you, and what was it about it that you found so inspirational?
Well, it was just such an interesting mix, the cultural mix, because it's what was happening was music was coming across the borders from Vietnam and the war, and they were hearing, you know, bands like The Doors, The Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, and there were some artists in Cambodia that just took it in their own direction. They were inspired by it, but they infused their own traditional music, and the product just was just really, it's interesting. It was like reverb, surf guitar, and Farfisa organ sounds, you know, Vox organs, and the vocals are what are really special because the language Khmer is very musical and sneaky, and it's just it's a great instrument on its own. But, you know, just to make it clear, we really were mainly influenced by this music for our first record, and I mean, it's always an influence, but for the last three records, we've just been writing original materials and kind of drawing from influences wherever we may find them.
Would you characterize your band as falling in the, in speech marks, world music camp? Because in the UK at least, and it's a subject that our listeners have been talking about recently, the term world music has a kind of staid, maybe slightly old-fashioned connotation.
Yeah, I was definitely afraid of that term as well for a while, because world music, you know, you could think of feel good, happy kind of festival, just not, that's not what we do, but it works for world music festivals, and it works for rock shows. We've played with everyone. I mean, some of the best bands that I've seen have been at world music festivals, that we played with, like Egypt 80, Sion Kuti from, you know, Africa, Egypt 80, the original band that backed up Fela Kuti. And I mean, and they just killed it so hard. So if that's world music, yeah, that's cool. I like that.
What are some of the more unusual festivals that you found yourself playing at?
We got to play WOMAD in New Zealand, which was pretty incredible, because to get to walk through this forest and then play to all these people and go surfing for 3 days before your show.
And how does that compare to playing to Cambodian villages?
It was pretty amazing because the cultural difference, one of them is when you finish the song, like true Cambodians, they don't really applaud. So it was like we'd be playing for about 1,000 people, and there would just be, after the song, there would just be dead silence. And just, it's like, whoa, they hate it, but they really liked it. They came up and embraced it. This was in 2005, and we went back again. And now it's kind of different. Now they were going crazy when we were there, because then it brought Westerners and Cambodians together into the nightclubs. Usually there's like a more of a separation, but it brought them all together, and they were just rocking out. And a lot of the songs that we were playing were old songs that came from their country.
You live in Phnom Penh. I check my email.
I'm taking up to fall asleep. So I write you back and count the days until we'll be together. The first thing that I do.
You brought a Cambodian singer into your band. How did that happen with the initial trip?
Once we decided that we wanted to do this band, we learned that there was a large Cambodian population in Long Beach, which is in California. We all live in Los Angeles, so we went down there to these nightclubs and just started watching performers and singers, and kind of trying some of them out in rehearsal studios down there. And it was like nothing was getting that. It didn't feel that special. These girls were a little bit. None of them had that strong of a voice, and their boyfriends were kind of shady gangsters, you know, trying to sell us weed on the side, like pounds of pot. And it just kind of just didn't feel right. And we went to another club, and there was it was called Dragon House, and that was where we met Chomney Mall, and she was on stage just singing with, she, there was like seven other singers up there, but she was in the middle singing solo and just filled the room. And my brother and I was just, we just looked at each other and he was like, oh, we got to ask her. Yeah. But she didn't speak any English. So it was just, it was like she was fresh off the boat, you know. So it was really hard. It took about 10 trips back to the Dragon House, and then she finally came to practice. And once we all played some of these songs together, it felt really special.
And tell me a bit about how you came to be involved in Meltdown, and what is your affiliation or appreciation, if any, for Ray Davies and the Kinks?
Yeah, well, we were on the Jules Holland show, and Ray Davies was on that day, and he was a guest, and he just was really cool. He picked us out of the band and was like, he like was talking to Jules, and he was like, hey, I like these guys live, and he's like, you remind me of Blondie and Led Zeppelin, and I've toured with them both. So we were just like, yeah, that's such a compliment coming from Ray. You know, we love the Kinks. I mean, the Kinks are very influential. So to be part of it, it's really good. I've only heard great things about Meltdown, so yeah, I can't wait.
Dengue Fever.
Yay.
Hey, I got it right. I've been pronouncing the name wrong all day, listeners, with Rosie there. It's because, that you know, when you read a word and you think that's how it's pronounced,
yeah,
and you know,
and that's how you pronounce it.
And that's how you pronounce it.
I know.
There'll always be Dengue Fever to me. interesting thing, though, isn't it? A bit of Cambodian, Cambodian pop. But there's been some quite intriguing compilations, I don't know, of perhaps dubious legality, of Cambodian pre-Khmer Rouge pop music.
Yeah.
That's sort of fascinating and strange sounding, and also obviously, on one level, just by default, incredibly tragic, because you just know all these people die. Mm. Everybody on these records is probably killed. But it's interesting to see them mining that kind of area. Okay, well, yeah, fascinating stuff. Dengue Fever, obviously, on the Meltdown bill. That's pretty much your lot, folks. My thanks as ever to Rosie for coming in. Thank you, Peter, as well, for coming in. If you'd like to find out more about Meltdown, the lineup, or get tickets, then have a look at the site, southbankcentre.co.uk. The programme is back next Friday. I'm Alexis Petridis. Our producer is Scott Cawley. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.